Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. We're double teaming today. My guests are the principals of the multimedia production company R Squared, R for Rachel, Rachel Fisher and Rachel Pasternak. They are the directors and producers of the powerful and riveting documentary Joachim Prince, I Shall Not Be Silent. It tells the story of a rabbi whose impassioned sermons at Berlin synagogues in the 1930s warned his fellow German Jews of what was to come, his expulsion to the United States, and his involvement with and commitment to the civil rights movement, helping to organize the 1963 March on Washington. This is not the two Rachels' first film. They produced Remembering Auschwitz, a documentary about the Polish town that became infamous as the site of Auschwitz. After getting her master's in Jewish studies, Rachel Pasternak worked in journalism, as well as communications and marketing. Rachel Fisher has a PhD in religious studies from the University of California and was the founding director of the Genealogy Institute at the Center for Jewish History in Manhattan. Was filmmaking a career either of you thought about or aspired to, and how, in fact, did your paths cross?
We are both storytellers and, you know, have professional backgrounds in history and have done oral history work and are writers and really believe in the importance of capturing stories. So we were brought together by a mutual friend who knew that we were both involved with oral history work and thought we would have a lot to talk about. And he was certainly very correct. And we did do some collaborating on family oral histories. And then that subsequently led to our collaboration with the 15-minute film Remembering Auschwitz.
You know, you make it sound so simple. We were into oral history, but transferring that to film is not so simple.
I was asked this question actually when I went back to the school that I graduated from, and I was being interviewed by a group of eighth grade girls. And they asked, did you always want to be a filmmaker? And my response to them was, no, I didn't always want to be a filmmaker, but I think that I always was a filmmaker without actually realizing it.
Interesting.
I think Rachel and I were probably both very avid readers as children. And I know for me that I always visualized the story that I was reading and that it was so real and so true and that I was sort of playing a film of it in my mind.
In your head. Uh-huh.
And that even during my my academic work, getting my PhD, that the history always really came alive for me in my mind and had a visual element to it. So that although we both began doing written work, I think, and I know that Rachel is also very visual and has a great visual sense and artistic sense. So I think that it didn't feel unnatural to
begin. I was just going to say, was it a natural set of progression?
It felt natural to add the visual element and to just bring the stories to even greater life. I think also that film is just a medium now in which stories are told. And if you want your story to be seen and heard by many people, that film is a great way to do that as opposed to, say, writing a book. So perhaps had we done this project 20 years ago, we might have written a book.
So you were clearly not overwhelmed by the prospect of telling Rabbi Prince's story.
Well, I just also wanted to backtrack, Sandy, because my initial idea, because Rabbi Prince's story to me was so captivating and he was such a dramatic figure, and I grew up going to a lot of theater, that the best place that I initially thought to present his story was on stage.
Huh.
And after meeting with Deborah Prince, Rabbi Prince's daughter, many, many years ago, we decided that the initial presentation of him to the world, let's say, would be film because it would be the most comprehensive. We could, you know, really interview and tell, you know, interview people and tell the farthest reaching story. Whereas on stage, you have to really whittle it down to certain.
And you certainly can't show pictures and footage in the same way.
Right. So, but then because, as I said, it was such a dramatic story and there was so much information out there, and we were lucky enough to have a lot of great people to interview with to really piece the story together. And Rabbi Prince had such an amazing, powerful voice.
Mm-hmm.
That was the other piece. Like, we really knew that we wanted to have his voice in the film as much as possible, that we were able to weave it together. And it wasn't overwhelming. I mean, we had to choose. There was so much archival material, and there was kind of a wealth of people to choose from in a way. So that was inspiring for us and helped spur us on because we had a lot of material.
So you never felt like either one of you were in over your head?
I don't think we felt that way creatively or artistically. Certainly, personally, managing everything. We both have children and families. So there were certainly moments, and that's when it's great to have a partner because usually it didn't happen at the same time. So
there's an ebb
sometimes
and flow.
Rachel would talk me down or I would talk her down and we would support each other that way.
Yeah.
So like anybody else that is working on a big project, of course, we had those moments. But I think creatively, we had each other and we had the people we were collaborating with to keep us going whenever we might feel overwhelmed, but we were always so inspired by Rabbi Prince's story that
you knew you had to tell it.
We knew the story was there, and it was just a matter of time.
Yeah, I think my commitment to the story was unwavering. I never ever thought that we were going to give up or leave it behind. It was always going to make a film, and each step of the way through meeting different people and fundraising, and when people would be generous enough to support us, that also was really encouraging for us and helped us to continue the process.
So why don't you start telling us about the process? How did Rabbi Prince come into your lives?
Rabbi Prince came into our lives when I was really in graduate school at the Jewish Theological Seminary, although I had known of him. And my mother grew up at his synagogue, and my grandparents were longtime members of Temple B'nai Abraham in Newark, which is now in Livingston. And actually, my mom had a recording of the March on Washington on an album, and she used to play that for us sometimes, and I would hear his speech, and I remember going to the temple very vaguely and hearing his voice, but I really didn't know much about him until I was in graduate school and looking for a research topic, and I was interested in finding out what rabbis were saying to their congregants in the 1940s, what they were saying from their pulpits in America about what was happening in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And though I didn't really find that, my grandfather and father said, you should look into Rabbi Prince. He was a real rabble-rouser. And they knew that he, stirred up controversy, and I would find something interesting in his material. So thanks to the generosity of Deborah Prince, who my family knew, I was introduced to her, and she said, come on in, and welcomed me into her basement where there were all these boxes. And it was there that I uncovered what was then his unpublished memoir.
So tell us the story of Rabbi Prince.
He was an assimilated German Jew. His family had lived in Germany for about 500 years. They, as we say in the film, they took a prayer book out about every once in a while when there was a thunderstorm. But they never really went to services. He was the only Jewish family in their town. And after losing his mother when he was about 13, with whom he was very close to, and he did not share a close relationship with his father, he sort of rebelled. I mean, his father wanted nothing to do with Judaism. He was a German patriot and, pushed Judaism aside.
A secular life. Huh?
Yes, as most German Jews did at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And he started to share a relationship with the rabbi in his town, Felix Goldman, and that brought him to services. And there was one Sabbath, where he was sitting in the service and was asked to hold the Torah, which was going to count as a member of the service so they could have a minyan.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he felt that the Torah, he had this moment, this aha moment, I guess we say now, where the velvet from the Torah scroll felt like his mother's skin. And
he had
this epiphany and said, I am going to devote myself to my mother and to by devoting myself to Judaism, I'll be devoting myself to my mother. And he, though his father wanted him to go into the family business, he tried that briefly, but he became increasingly interested in Zionism. And through that and leading youth groups, leading a Zionist youth group, he eventually went on to become a rabbi.
Did he study to be a rabbi?
Yes. I mean, in Germany, you also had to study something secular. So he studied philosophy and I think also art history. And then he studied at the Breslau Seminary in Germany. And he went on to become a rabbi there. And then, like for all of us, right, our context for which we're living influences the path we take. So what was happening in Germany, he quickly could sense when the treatment of Jews was changing because he was completely assimilated and his Christian neighbors were no longer looking at them.
So this is in the 30s now. And he's how old?
In the 30s. He was born in 1902, so he was in his 20s.
Mm-hmm.
I believe he was the youngest rabbi
When he became a rabbi in Berlin, he was the youngest of the group of rabbis.
Is that something he aspired to go to Berlin, to leave his small community and be in such a large city?
Well, he studied in Breslau, so I guess that was already bigger than where he had been. And then I guess
anything was bigger than where he had been.
And the way, I don't know that he inspired to be in Berlin, but the way the Jewish community worked, like that was probably where most of the Jews were. Mm-hmm. And that's where the work was. That's where his, uh-huh. he was a communal rabbi. That's the way it worked in Germany. So he would go to different
synagogues
and preach.
But I think that early in his life, Joachim Prince knew that he had a special voice, a different voice, and a powerful voice. And he did take himself to places where that voice could be used in the best service of the Jewish people and of justice and of all of the things that he believed in. So he often found himself in, you know, large settings. Like in Berlin, he would preach in the large synagogue so that many, many people could come.
Was he considered a visiting rabbi?
The way it worked there was very different than the way it works here. The rabbis were all employed by the community, and they didn't have a set synagogue that was their congregation. So they were all the rabbis of Berlin, and I don't know exactly how it was decided, mm-hmm. but they would preach at the different synagogues on different days.
Very interesting.
One very influential piece of that is that at that time, most German Jews were assimilated, and Rabbi Prince's role became one where he was really educating the Jews who were sitting at his service. When they increasingly became discriminated against, they started to realize, I am a Jew in name, but I don't know what that means. So his role was to not only preach, but to really teach them about their Jewish history. And he published many books on Jewish history. He published a children's Bible. He was really
proactive.
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, my guests today are Rachel Fisher and Rachel Pasternak, directors and producers of a really amazing documentary, Joachim Prinz, I Shall Not Be Silent. So why did he know what other Jews didn't know? Because I said in my introduction that during his sermons, he was warning the other Jews of things to come and to get out of Germany. Why only he?
A few things. Of course, it wasn't only him. There were a few other people who understood how dire the situation was.
Were they as vocal as he?
No, they weren't all as vocal, but there were some other rabbis who spoke out against the Nazi regime.
Mm-hmm.
Joachim, though, always had a sense of otherness that I think came from, again, this deep relationship that he had had with his mother and the separation that he felt from his father and from, by association, from Germany. So that even though he was of Germany and spoke beautiful German, he had a sense of having a strong Jewish identity and a sense of otherness, and also had been very influenced, as Rachel said, by his Zionism. So that because he was less identified with Germany to begin with, it was less of a dissonance. There was less dissonance for him when the German people elected Hitler and began to take these steps to disenfranchise the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
There was less dissonance for him than perhaps there were for other people who were more identified with their German nationality.
Like not actually a disconnect, but certainly a different level of intensity.
Well, I was just going to say the other thing, and to add to what Rachel said, is that he grew up, he had these babysitters who helped raise him, and he went to church with them. They were literally the only Jewish family in this town of Opeln when he was born. Or he wrote about how when there was a funeral, they all stood in the street and said, Father, Son, the Holy Spirit. So this was his community. You know, he was part of the Christian community. And mm-hmm. And I actually think that that's something that Rachel and I both relate to, because we both have backgrounds where we're Jewish, but we were very much a part of the secular world in mm-hmm. different and very personal ways. Mm-hmm. And we share that with Rabbi Prince. So I think that's also where the intensity came from, where he had these close relationships with his German neighbors. And then, you know, it really changed.
So he preaches, he warns, and he gets arrested on numerous occasions. He would be arrested and then he would be released. There was a lot of this back and forth going on. Was that not odd?
He writes about how he was really able to, like, intellectualize the situation and talk to the Nazis in a certain way where he could kind of manipulate the situation in a way. I think he used his gift of language to some extent. And then I think the other extent is that he was lucky.
The other thing is that when we look back at this history, because we know what happened, we anticipate the brutal violence that's to come. But in the beginning, there was more of a creep. which is why it was so difficult for people to understand what was happening, so that he wasn't the only rabbi who was arrested and then released and arrested and then released. They weren't loading people on trains right
from
the
get-go. At that
point,
right.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
There was a creep, so that, you know, it's like the frog in the boiling water, right? Mm-hmm. You don't mm-hmm. notice that it's getting hotter and hotter. But he was able to notice that, unlike many people. But I think that the way you're thinking about it is with the hindsight that we all have
now. Good
point,
of course.
There were beatings of people and there were killings of people, but the organized violence came a little bit later. And everyone has always wondered why the Nazis chose to expel him rather than—
They saved his life.
He came to the United States in 1937 after being told that he had to leave Germany. And that's always been a question, and it may be that someday we'll discover in Nazi archives what their thinking was. I suspect that the power of his voice may have had something to do with that, that it was more dangerous for them to do violence to him because he had such a following.
He would be martyred.
Exactly, than it was for them to just try to get rid of him.
So it was the Nazis cutting their losses.
Right. Uh-huh. Possibly.
Yes,
we
yes.
don't have
of course,
evidence.
We didn't. Yes,
this is
exactly.
our speculation.
And then he was able to be sponsored. That took work, but he was brought over here through a cousin and through Rabbi Stephen Wise. And without that, I don't know where he would
What would have
been,
happened but. To him? And he had a family at that point. He
yes.
was married and he had mm-hmm. two young children, I believe.
Yes.
How successful was he in convincing his fellow German Jews to get out of Germany in enough time and to go to Palestine?
Well, according to people who knew him then and knew people in Germany then, his son Jonathan says in the film that due to his preaching and his words, thousands of people left Germany and are in Israel and other places around the world.
He was particularly successful with young people. He spent a lot of time with young people. He was very invested. And he himself was young.
Sure.
But he had a youth group. And so a lot of these teenagers— rebelled in a sense against their own parents by becoming followers of Joachim Prince. Mm-hmm. And many of them took it upon themselves to go to Palestine, partly as a result of his influence.
Yeah, and it was twofold. It was this idea, right, like we need to leave Germany because it's dangerous, but it was also the idea of embracing this dream of Palestine.
So he leaves Germany and he comes to the United States and he gets smacked in the face here too, doesn't he? About what's going on in our country.
Yes, he was hired by what was then the United Palestine Appeal to travel around America and to speak to Jewish audiences about what was happening in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And once again, you know, people didn't really want to hear what he had to say. And we uncovered in our archives people writing letters to the editor and articles about saying, you know, how dare he speak about what's happening at the end of German Jewry is coming. Again, people didn't want to believe it.
And it was in these travels of traveling around the country, giving these lectures, that he saw racism in America, particularly in the South.
South, yeah.
And realized and identified so closely with what African Americans were experiencing because it reminded him of exactly what he had experienced in Germany.
So what was the genesis of his connection to the civil rights movement? I mean, he became involved with Dr. Martin Luther King. That's pretty
right.
big.
So Prince came to the United States under the mentorship of Rabbi Stephen Wise, who was the head of the American Jewish Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And so he became involved in the American Jewish Congress, Prince did, and slowly rose up in the ranks of that organization. And once Prince had his own pulpit in Newark, New Jersey,
mm-hmm.
of Temple B'nai Abraham, he continued to work in the American Jewish Congress. And it was really through that organization, which already had ties to civil rights organizations, that he met Martin Luther King and a lot of other civil rights leaders like Roy Wilkins and began to work with them. And when he became president of the American Jewish Congress, he then threw the full weight of the organization behind the civil rights cause.
Sure, there's a lot more power.
And that really gave him—he met Stephen Wise still when he was in Germany through the World Jewish Congress. I guess Prince really embraced, you know, this idea of having a platform and becoming involved in world affairs, not just his own small community. And when we see speeches that he gave early on at the American Jewish Congress, it was— it really gave him a wonderful platform to speak not only to about what was going on locally, but to really think about what was what were his ideals for the Jewish community in America, and gave him, as I keep saying, a platform, mm-hmm. but a whole arena, really.
Did he have a lot of support among his congregants? Did he transfer his focus from, you know, American Jewry to what was happening to African
Americans? Did he transfer that to other people?
Yes.
I think for many people, yes. Mm-hmm. I think for many people, yes. And for others, they always wondered why he cared so much about civil rights.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, my grandparents, who were longtime members of the congregation, said we went to pray as we went to learn as from Rabbi Prince as much as we did to pray. So he was really enlightening his congregants in on many levels. And I think there were people who didn't understand, like Rachel said, why he was choosing to become so involved in current affairs. And he continued to do that. And you know, some people say the role of a rabbi should just be, you know, stick to religion and stay with your synagogue.
Mm-hmm.
But he always felt like his quote was, religion is not some, you know, something that should exist in splendid isolation. It needs to be, as Rabbi Friedman says in our film, in the streets.
And that's also one of the reasons he identified so closely with Martin Luther King, because here was another preacher who was taking religion to the streets and trying to carry out the vision of the prophets in contemporary life.
What did Dr. King think of Rabbi Prince?
As far as we can tell from the archival material, he admired him and appreciated him. We have correspondence between them. They saw each other as allies.
Mm-hmm.
So Rabbi Prince would write letters and send telegrams to political figures, and he would CC Dr. King.
Uh-huh.
So that King would know what he was doing. And then King would write letters in support of what Prince was doing and vice versa. So, and I'm sure they did that with other leaders as well who were all engaged in the civil rights movement. They all tried to work together and support what the other was doing. So, you know, we have a letter where Martin Luther King had published a book and sent a copy, a complimentary copy, to Rabbi Prince and said he was eager to hear what he thought of it. And so as far as we can tell, they had a very collegial and warm relationship.
Which there's a very – it's a very powerful moment. There are many powerful moments in your documentary. But when there's this, the March on Washington in 63, and there is Rabbi Prince speaking to the crowd of tens of thousands with this impassioned, powerful speech. Can you give a little synopsis of what he had to say, although everybody should watch the movie? But
Well, you know, the name of it is The Problem is Silence. So he really took people on his journey in about 5 minutes on his speech about how it was through his experience in Berlin where he saw people act like bystanders and remain silent in the face of evil, in the face of hatred, and how he so, with all of his heart, did not want that to be the situation in America. And he said America must not become a nation of silent onlookers. And
so powerful.
I think he really resonated with the crowd. And again, he talked about neighbor not being a geographic term, as he himself saw his neighbors turn from becoming friends to treating him like a stranger.
Mm-hmm.
So he really weaved together very powerfully the genesis of his perspective of seeing what would happen in Germany and how we here in America must speak up and speak out so that this children's oath, the Pledge of Allegiance, remains true.
We take a little bit for granted now, again, with hindsight, that the Jewish narrative from slavery to freedom and from pogroms to becoming immigrants to the United States and from of what happened in Germany and of the Holocaust, that all of those stories have parallels in the African-American story. But Prince was among the first people who created that parallel, who recognized that parallel and who honored it and who wanted to share his story and find the commonalities.
And publicized it.
Right, right. And essentially gave that story to the audience there, to the crowd at the March on Washington, and said, you know, you're not taking this from me. I'm giving this to you. This is something that we share together.
Right.
That I understand what you're experiencing. I've been in that place myself.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're not crazy. You're not crazy to think that that this hatred that you feel is really frightening and that we need to do something about it, that I acknowledge you, I recognize you, and I agree with you, and I will stand with you.
And then beyond that, in his speech, he also says that the purpose is not to speak up, is not just for Black America. You know, he opened up to say this is not just about African Americans. This is about all of us. Mm-hmm. And if one person's freedom is threatened, all of our freedom is threatened.
My guests today are Rachel Fisher and Rachel Pasternak, directors and producers of a really amazing documentary, Joachim Prinz, I Shall Not Be Silent. It's interesting, isn't it, that your movie is now in tandem with Selma, the feature film about the march from Selma to Montgomery.
This is going to be now the 50th anniversary of the passage of the Voting Rights Act. And we have a powerful scene in the film as well where there's a Black man speaking to a police officer who's acting in a very unkind way, trying to push him out, to trying to prevent him from voting. Well, so that takes on, like you're saying, an even more powerful meaning now here in 2015.
Well, and also in these past months about people needing voter identification. Isn't it stunning? Everything old is new again.
That's right.
It's just amazing.
That's right.
Your film has been seen a lot of places. You must be so proud of it, and just so, and still, you just get the chills from the reactions that it receives. Do you never tire of that, or do you ever tire of that?
It's great. I mean, one of our goals has always been to turn the material of the film into curriculum for kids in high school and universities. So that is probably one of the best outcomes of these screenings, is to connect with students. We had a great screening last year that was organized by the late Professor Clement Price at the Newark Museum, in which groups of kids from three different high schools came to see the film. And they said, you know, afterwards, why did we not know about this?
Wow.
How could we not have known about this man? And we didn't know about this shared history between Blacks and Jews. So the fact that the film is inspiring young people, again, just like Rabbi Prinz always did.
But you're carrying out his legacy.
So that's really very, very satisfying.
You should be so proud of yourselves. What's next for you guys?
We are hoping to find another project about which we're equally as passionate. We haven't found it yet, but we know it's there. And we would like to collaborate with, you know, other producers, with cultural institutions to tell more stories, stories that would otherwise be lost in history.
And we're also excited about finally turning the material from the film into curriculum so that we can begin to have the film be shown in schools and become part of a dialogue with the students.
That's quite a large job, isn't it?
I think that
a big undertaking.
I think it's doable. We have all the material from the film, and then we'll connect with someone who is, that's their expertise with building, writing curriculum. Mm-hmm. And then we'll, through our distributor, Menemsha Films in Los Angeles, they will help us carry that out and send it out, you know, make it available to schools across the country.
We don't think, even though, of course, we will move on and tell other stories, but we hopefully will never be finished telling Rabbi Prinz's story. We have a lot of wonderful material that didn't make it into the film. Mm-hmm. And Rachel mentioned that she always had the idea of doing a play. Mm-hmm. There are many different genres in which this story can be told to reach different audiences, different age groups. And we really have all of the historical material about Rabbi Prinz that we've done, you know, a dissertation's worth of research.
To say the least.
Yes. Yeah, so we think that throughout the rest of our lives, we will continue to produce more stories about Rabbi Prinz as well as other stories.
You too shall not be silent. Thank you so much for joining me today, Rachel Fisher and Rachel Pasternak, and for bringing an amazing man's story to life. It's just a wonderful, impassioned, powerful documentary that everybody should see.
Thank you so much for having us, Sandy.
Thank you.
Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.